Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politics. You know, staying as current as we possibly can. We're talking with a lady by the name of Seema Iyer. We're going to talk about a new network that she has just started along with her colleagues. But before we talk about that, we're going to talk about the current situation that is hitting all the wire services right now, and that is the arrest of Julian Assange. Seema is an expert in political subjects, and so I asked her if she could discuss this right away, and she said yes, of course. What are your thoughts, Seema?
First off, Al, thank you so much for having me on. And yeah, yesterday was a big day. You know, I was watching Mr. Assange be taken out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, kicking and screaming. I saw it on a loop. And my initial thoughts are that this is about 9 years too late.
Yeah.
Because the original investigation, right, it began in 2010. And this is when he was alleged to have conspired with Chelsea Manning. And now, you know, this is just snowballed since 2010. He gets different allegations coming out of Sweden for rape and molestation. Then he's alleged to have been a part of orchestrating the email dump in 2016 tied to the election. So, yeah, I think this is about time. But I also think, Al, there's a lot of serious First Amendment press issues, journalistic issues that are tied up in all this.
You know, Seema, I have to agree with you 100%. First Amendment is very important to me, having done radio for an awful long time now and being a consultant
Sure.
before that. First Amendment is very important to me. Actually, we're going to address that question again with Dr. John Huber in the final segment, talking about political correctness, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, Julian Assange, in my opinion, in terms of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, now, how do you feel about this? I'm not really sure that he broke any laws. But then again, Seema, I'm not an attorney. How do you feel?
Well, see, okay, this is a really, I would say, weak case for what he is charged with. Okay, so right now, he is only charged with a single crime. That's it, just a single crime, conspiracy to commit computer intrusion, which for listeners is basically hacking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, did he conspire with Chelsea Manning, who was then known as Bradley Manning, did he conspire and essentially hack the classified Department of Defense computer system? And that's the problem. So the publishing of the information, that's when we get into these First Amendment protection issues. That isn't the crime. The crime is the hacking. And why I say it's weak, again, this is just my legal conjecture, is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that Julian Assange assisted or conspired with. You know, they have the same state of mind as Manning to hack the computer system. What we have heard, that it is more likely that Manning was already downloading information off the servers, and then Assange just said, all right, keep on going. We
right.
want more. You know, so, and this is interesting because, so myself as a lawyer and now a journalist as well, a lot of times I did investigative reporting. I'm doing investigative reporting here at Court TV. If a source comes to you and says, hey, I have these documents, you can say, great, if you have more, call me, give them over. So I'm not actually procuring the information, I am publishing the information.
Correct.
And that, Al, is the line.
Pretty interesting. You know, I have to say the internet has certainly opened up a real bucket of worms in terms of situations like this. I'm going to be talking about that later in the show with a real expert on that one also. But the fact of the matter is, I believe that the internet is so unregulated right now. I'm not really quite sure, Seema, how we could get to the point where this guy broke any laws. As you say yourself, as an attorney, your opinion, and I want to underline the word opinion, is that...
Yes.
And I want to underline the word opinion, but is that it's a pretty weak case, correct?
I think it's a weak case because if you're looking at it from a purely forensic technology standpoint, right, the government would have to show that Manning and Assange worked together, shared the same mindset, and hacked into the server. They actually got together and hacked into that system. So it's a very technical requirement that would require forensic experts and expertise. You can't just use what was published as evidence against him. Does that make sense? Like, you can't get to the conclusion and then say, okay, we're going to work backward and try to retroactively make a case.
I believe that would be called entrapment, wouldn't it?
A lot of people say that about the feds. I'm telling you, people say the feds do this all the time. So, yeah. And like I said, you know, in 2010, that's when Julian Assange first came on our radar. But he's been increasingly more so within the conversation in terms of President Trump, Roger Stone, WikiLeaks in and of itself, and the other crimes that he's been accused of.
Mm-hmm. I got a question for you. I mean, you know, the one thing the internet has brought on in terms of instant information is we're getting information right now that is much more sophisticated. And let me say this, the techniques used for getting the information is much more sophisticated than in the days of the Pony Express or what have you. But, you know, I got to tell you, I am somewhat concerned. I mean, being a journalist, the access, almost immediate access to events as they occur, I think is really great, but there's an awful lot of room within that for misunderstanding. Now, getting back to Assange just for a second, I would have to look at what he has done, and again, this is just an emotional reaction on my part, is purely and simply a service to the public, and he's using the most effective medium that there is.
Of course. Listen, it's there for the taking, right? And
Yep.
I'm sure you remember. You remember back with the Drudge Report when Michael Isikoff from the Newsweek, you know, he was, I think he was with the Washington Post and he went to Newsweek and he really had the whole Monica Lewinsky story, but Newsweek wouldn't let him publish it.
Right.
So Matt Drudge said, I'm going to publish it. You know, I've got this thing called the internet and it's just there for the taking. So here, it's beyond that. How many years ago was that? What was that, 20, 25 years ago? I can't, I'm dating myself. So now it's a free-for-all. And by the way, okay, so when you publish something on the web in and of itself, it is accessible through normal means. We're not even talking about the dark web, what's out there if you really infiltrate the internet, what we could really find. And so that's why there is this fine line of, how much should we regulate this as opposed to freedom of speech, freedom of the press, other First Amendment issues?
Yep. Well, we can go on and on and on about that, but we got to take a real quick break here in just about 30 seconds. I have to take a commercial break. But having said that, Seema, I have to tell you, I am very, very concerned about the internet right now. I consider it to be a real advantage for people who do what I do. It's a real advantage, in my opinion, for people who want to maintain a high level of political, and I'm going to use a funny word here, astuteness. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be right back with Seema Iyer. We're going to talk a little bit about her new network. Stick around right after the break. We'll be right back.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Continue my discussion with Seema Iyer. Some very, very interesting thoughts from Seema, who is an attorney, regarding the Julian Assange case. I'm very, very intrigued with that personally. Having said that, I'm also very, very intrigued with what Seema and her colleagues are doing. Seema is slated to be an anchor on a new network called Court TV. Tell us about it, Seema.
Thank you for asking, Al.
Oh,
so yes, Court TV existed for a really long time. It's an iconic brand. It was we were around from 1991 to approximately 2009, and then there were different incarnations that followed. And so we are relaunching in May of 2019. I think we could probably give the exact date within the next week. We're going to announce that. And we have an exemplary line of lawyers / journalists. We have correspondents that are going to cover the nation's most riveting courtroom dramas, and we're going to be 24 hours a day. We're a network. We're going to be live 12 hours of that day. And we are just so grateful and excited. And Al, there is nothing like Court TV that has been on television since the original Court TV. So we're back.
Well, I tell you, I'm looking forward to watching it here in the great Pacific Northwest where I live. As listeners are aware, I'm pretty isolated. I'm actually really isolated where the development I live in is pretty isolated. Most of us are here not because we're crazy survivalists, but we're here because we just want to be left alone. And it's an absolutely wonderful place to be. Now, tell me a little bit about your background, if you would, Seema.
Well, I, like you, Al, I really like to be left alone, so I'm a little jealous right now.
You don't want to say a word.
I am really jealous of that because it sounds pretty spectacular where you are. But, yeah, so I'm a former prosecutor I was a prosecutor in the Bronx, New York City.
Oh,
and soon after that, I went on to my own criminal defense practice. I'm a solo practitioner in New York City, traveled also around the country doing cases, different states. I had those opportunities as well. So most of my background has been in criminal defense. And then I actually went back to school at night a few years ago, and I developed an expertise in biochemistry. So specifically, I focused on DNA, forensic psychiatry, forensic medicine, forensic science, forensic technology, and I just spent most of my career trying cases. And then, actually, before I really took the dive into journalism, I was working for the NYPD, and it was a really special job to represent the NYPD. It was wonderful. And then I said, okay, I'm going to try journalism, and I went into local news for a little while, and I was there. I loved it. But Court TV, these guys who kind of got together and said, we're going to bring it back, they plucked me out of local news and said, you got to come here. And so now I'm in Atlanta, the worldwide headquarters of Court TV. And we are really working around the clock to make this happen on time. It's really exciting.
Well, I gotta tell you, you couldn't be living in a better city. A good friend of mine who is the president of the Mises Institute, Jeff Deist, just lives across the border from you over in Auburn, Alabama. And I guarantee you're going to have a knock on your door at some point in the future. And I'd love to meet you in person. But having said that, I want to talk more about Court TV. Now, is the emphasis here going to be on current events, i.e. newsroom stuff, or are we talking about current events in terms of currently scheduled and ongoing legal trials?
I love the question. Thank you for it, Al. So it is going to be focused on courtroom trials that are currently in the news. So let's give you an example, the Harvey Weinstein case. That is set for trial in June. We are deeply dived into that, and we're preparing to cover the Weinstein trial. We're not sure if cameras are going to be in the courtroom, but either way, we're going to be covering that. Now, at the same time, while we cover one trial, we'll still be keeping our viewers posted on other legal news, other trials that are happening in the country. So we're just going to, you know, we're solely devoted to legal news, but we're trying to bring as much information to the public because there hasn't been that. You know, there hasn't been a network that's going to show you gavel-to-gavel coverage, and that's what we're going to do.
I guess one comment I would make is God bless you, and the reason I would say that is because God bless you, but quite apart from that, I want to say that I think it is really, really an interesting universe that you're going to be, for lack of better terms, operating within. I'm not sure that, I mean, sure, the Harvey Weinstein thing has been all over the air. There's no question about that. It's been in the print, it's been in audio, it's been on TV, et cetera, et cetera. But I have to tell you, some of the political trials that I think are probably going to result whenever the Democrats get done with their witch hunt, for lack of better terms, I think are going to be absolutely fascinating. And I kind of view what you're doing is very similar to the coverage that the live coverage that went on, only this will be obviously in a different sense, of the Kavanaugh hearing. And I got to tell you,
I was glued. I was in local news then. Oh my God, I was in local news then, and I was investigative reporter, legal correspondent, anchor. So my boss said, hey, this is your job. You just sit and watch this all day. It was heaven. It was like my version of Disneyland. So yeah. I think we will, I will say this, Core TV, you know, our plan is to cover everything. So I think it will, you know, it depends on the trial. If it's a federal trial, I mean, certainly we'll be providing the news and the updates, sure. But whether we'll get cameras in the courtroom, it's different. Hurdle when it's federal, but you bring up a really interesting point, and one that people have asked, are we going to be covering those trials? So hopefully the answer is yes, but either way, the news and the updates constantly will be delivered.
You know, I got to tell you, I am absolutely fascinated. I'm not an attorney, but I did quite a bit of work with the consulting work for the Securities and Exchange Commission. So I have a lot of friends who are in the legal profession, and I have to tell you, my favorite author, bar none, and this is coming from a guy who, among other degrees, has a Bachelor of Arts degree in Russian literature, the best literature in the world. But I got to tell you, I am absolutely fascinated by a guy who lives right down in your neck of the woods by some of his books, and that is John Grisham. Having said not trying to plug John Grisham, he's an interesting author, I have to say. Thanks so much, Seema. Pleasure talking to you.
Al, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. You know, I got to tell you, Amy is a very interesting person. I know that that particular subject wasn't particularly relevant to politics, but I have to tell you, this is the first show, aside from the giant called NBC, that has aired her story. She was on NBC last Sunday. She was probably on for an hour. I'm not talking about some little station someplace. I'm talking about the NBC network. On this program, what we try to do is we try to educate you about the positive things in life. And I got to tell you, what Amy Jane is doing is she's doing something that, in my opinion, is very, very positive. And that's why I wanted to air that in KER Politics. Having said that, another guy who's, I have to say, very, very positive and a real inspiration to me is a guy named Dr. John Huber. Dr. Huber, I guess I should say, out of respect. His publicist, Ryan McCormick, is very, very, very prolific in terms of sending out information about John almost on a daily basis. And a couple of the missives that he has sent me really got my attention. And I think they are topics that you need to be aware of. Now, this is not opinion, ladies and gentlemen. This is cold, hard facts from a fellow with a PhD in psychology, a very well-known man in his industry, John Huber. John, you are talking right now, among other things, and the first one I want to deal with has to do with the downside, the dangers to society of the internet. You got the mic, man. You can go on as long as you want. I found that to be a fascinating, fascinating topic.
Well, I think everybody knows about the potential danger for young children and like that. So I'm not going to go into how kids can be exploited and stuff like that. I'm talking about the subtle dangers that people don't realize happens to them. And, you know, we've talked before about social media and its addictive properties and how people do become addicted to the social media, the likes and the attention you get on there from people who you may not actually know. And, you know, we've talked about it, but chemically what happens is if somebody gives you a like, you get a little bit of a dopamine bump, very much like you do if you were using heroin, only not as intense and not as strong. And when that bump goes away, which it doesn't last very long, it's very subtle, but it leaves you craving more. And so you do more things on social media. And what we find out is that you stay involved in that and you start getting attached to it, not just because there are people there who are paying attention to you, but there's this emotional outlet there. And in fact, it's designed in such a way that it is trying to get you to be as emotional as possible. That does a lot of things. One of the things it does is it makes you more susceptible to advertisement, which are on things like Facebook. And Facebook knows this, and they've actually done studies of this. And just recently, University of Buffalo out of New York did this study, and they watched and they measured people's intelligence quotient, their IQ, as they were online versus offline. And what they found out is the more you're online, the less your brain thinks rationally, and it actually lowers your IQ score while you're functioning in that social media world. Now, that makes you more susceptible to more emotional reactivity, and it lowers your IQ even more, slows down your cognitive thought process, throws down your ability to defend against things maybe not so honest advertising, maybe some political pushing and persuading that is not completely honest and truth, and it makes you more likely to fall for that type of stuff. And that's very disturbing on lots of levels. But if we think about ourselves as being animals, which we are basically biologically, we have higher cognitive functions, but we're still animals. And what we know is biology, nature wants us to take the path of least resistance. Just like water going downhill, it's going to go around boulders. It's going to go around trees instead of trying to go through them. What happens is our brain actually shuts down centers in our brain to save and conserve energy when we have access to these types of electronics. In fact, here in Texas, University of Texas in Austin, they did a study about 2 years ago, maybe it was 3 years ago. I don't remember the exact date. But what they did is they had professors at the university create their tests, but make two different tests that are identical, that assess the same thing, same content, and split one test into two. And then what they did is they had one group of students come in and take the test with their cell phones out visible, not turned on, just out on the desk visible. And then had another group take the test at the same time with their cell phones actually locked up in another room where they couldn't see it. It was not accessible to them. And then they took a break and had both groups switch. So one of them had the cell phone out in front of them that had it locked up, and the one that had them out before it now had their phone locked up. And what they found out was, regardless of whether they went first or second with their cell phone locked up, if their cell phone was not available for them, they scored higher on the test than if they had the cell phone out there. And that supports that theory that your brain is shutting down different areas in itself to conserve energy, because why think about it when you can just look it up on the cell phone, on Google, for example? And in fact, I've had several, and I had this discussion earlier this morning with one of my patients, how he was finding it difficult now to remember how to get places that he used to go all the time because he turns on his travel app that right. tells him where to turn and everything else. So he's actually finding it difficult. And even though he's been to these places thousands of times over his life, he still has this urge, I have to turn on my maps program to be able to get there. And it's because your brain is conserving energy, and it, in effect, is dumbing down this country, and it's making us not think clearly. And we wonder why we have young people coming up who know no world without smartphones. I mean, they hit the ground in 2007 for the public, so we're talking 12 years of cell phones. Most people didn't get them until they were, you know, 10, 12, 13 years old. So these people are in their 20s. Maybe as old as 24, 25 years old, and they don't really know a world without smartphones.
No, they really don't, John. I want to just interrupt you for a second, and I just want okay. to bring up a point. One of the reasons I really wanted to focus on this particular subject is because I'm involved in our neighborhood in some what I would call heavy intellectual heavy intellectual endeavors. Okay, we have a book club, and we don't talk about, you know, we don't talk about the Hardy Boys and things like that. We talk about very sophisticated novels. And I have to say, we have one guy in that book club, a good friend of mine, who cannot answer a question without pulling out his iPhone. Now, the result of that is he appears to be very, very bright, because if you want to know when, you know, when did Sinclair Lewis write Elmer Gantry? Well, he'll pull out his cell phone and he'll tell you exactly, you know, when, you know, the famous line, slide into second base for Jesus, occurred. The fact of the matter is, I am terrified by the mind control, John, that exists in our country primarily because of the internet. I don't know a single individual, and I have to say most of my friends are pretty sophisticated, pretty successful, and pretty bright. And I want to just say one other thing that I'd like you to comment on, then we got to take a real quick commercial break. But they are totally addicted to their laptops, 100%. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that that is a real danger, and that's what I'm talking about, the dangers of the internet, of cell phones, social media, is we don't even realize it's happening to us. It's creeping up and becoming part of us. It's kind of like the old Star Trek, you know, the Borg, they've assimilated.
Yeah.
And I recommend people take a break. Take at least one day a week.
You gotta take a break. You gotta take a break, and we have to take a break right now. Dr. John Huber, I really appreciate this conversation. We're gonna be right back, guys. Continuing an intellectual pursuit with Dr. John Huber, PhD in psychology, very well known in his part of the world, very well known throughout the country, throughout a radio network that he is actually the chairman of. Let me just say one thing. The pitfalls, in my opinion, of extensive usage of laptops and smartphones is very, very frightening to me, John.
And I think rightfully so. I think we need to be cognizant of the potential. I think we have some very huge conglomerates that probably need to be decentralized or broken up. And, you know, I don't know how or what should happen. I know that in the past we've had other industries that the government has stepped in and broken up to keep one organization from having so much control and power over our country. I think that whether you're talking of Google or Apple or any of those organizations, I think all of them are much bigger than those other conglomerates back in the time when those were breaking up. Al, you would probably be better at that as an economist to go back and talk about those things and those industries. But you know, that may be an option we may be forced to fall into, especially now when we hear testimony from Google and how they are, you know, right now, it came out today, how they admitted that their computer assistant that listens to your commands and can turn your TV on and do all these other kind of things, that they actually have individuals listening in and listening to people's conversations, even when they think that computer app, whatever, or it's not an app, it's a physical thing called Alexa, that Alexa is even on and they don't even realize. And they've talked about and disclosed that they have heard intimate interactions with each other. They've heard people talking about banking and finance with their personal, you know, bank representative on the phone, and got social security numbers and bank card numbers and stuff over the phone. And supposedly this was all, artificial intelligence and no humans listening to this. And, you know, they're only using information to help you. Yet we see marketing happening all the time. Somebody has a discussion about the new model of car coming out, and all of a sudden their social media is flush with advertisements for that type of car and different dealers who sell that. I've seen it myself with a friend who I don't use Apple products. I'm an Android person, but one of my partners in my practice. And we were sitting there at lunch one day, and we were talking about a very specific type of headphones that has noise canceling and all that kind of stuff on it, because we do some specialized therapy in my practice. And we were talking about using that to block out other sound and everything else while we were eating lunch. And we get in the car, and I'm driving, and all of a sudden he starts laughing, because he pulled up social media on the way back to the office, and he had three commercials right there, three advertisements for that very exact set of headphones that we had talked about.
Big Joe, let me just say one thing real quick. Sorry to interrupt you, but Kathy and I were talking last night, probably 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, and we happened to have the Seattle Mariners, Kansas City Royals baseball game on, because we're kind of Mariner fans. You know, they're having a good year to start. But anyway, I'll tell you what happened that was absolutely terrifying to me. About 3 minutes into our conversation, we have an Alexa unit in our living room where we listen to music from it. And the Alexa unit broke into our conversation, swear to God, John, and said, "I'm sorry, I didn't get that." I looked at Kathy and I said, what's going on? Now I know what's going on, John. Alexa is listening.
Yes. It's Big Brother, only it's corporate. It's not government.
Yep.
And then we sit back and we look at tax deductions and tax benefits they've been getting from the federal government, from not only our country, but other countries, these organizations, these corporations.
Right.
And I wonder why. I think they're in there sharing information with these governments. And maybe I sound like a black helicopter person at this point, but, you know, I've been in enough litigation as an expert witness, and I've heard other people testify, and I know that they're capable of doing that. This isn't far-fetched. This isn't technology that hasn't happened yet. This is technology that's here, and I won't have an Alexa in my house. I refuse to have those. And, you know, I think, you know, smartphones are a great tool if you use them wisely, but they need to be charged up out in the living room where you're not having intimate interactions with your significant others. I think smart televisions need to have cameras taken away and not be allowed on there because they're taking pictures of people and watching people.
That's right.
People have hacked into smart televisions and watched families watching their movies and stuff like that. People don't realize, and this generation we just talked about who have known no world without it, they are fearless about, you know, sharing intimate pictures with each other, for example. And they think, oh, well, everybody does it. And they don't have this understanding that those pictures are there now forever, and they will be forever.
You know, John, I've got a friend who's been on the show a number of times. He happens to be an expert both on the buy side and the sell side when it comes to medical insurance, et cetera, you know, payer, payee, et cetera, et cetera. he refuses to use a network. He has what he calls a VPN, virtual private network. He said, I won't use a network anymore because they scare the daylights out of me.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
John, well, I pay special fee to have a HIPAA compliant place to be able to accept and receive medical information because I'm concerned with that exact same thing.
Exactly. I don't blame you. John, I want to go to a different subject just for a second here. We've got about 2 minutes left here. Please be cognizant of that.
Yes.
Ryan also sent me some information on the acceptance or lack of acceptance of political correctness in the country. Can you elaborate?
Well, what's happened is we found out that 80% of Americans in general are sick and tired of political correctness. 74% or 72% actually of people ages 24 to 30 something, you know, the millennials are tired of political correctness, and 79% of the people under the age of 24 that were surveyed were against political correctness. And I think what's happened is we've gotten to a point where we can't have a discourse anymore, because the minute somebody doesn't like what you say, they start going off, oh, you're offending me, you have to stop that.
Right.
And the realization is that this country has become a great country because of the ability to exchange ideas, whether you like those person's ideas or not. And we can sit down and discuss those and work through them and find out what the benefits are and the bad sides of all that. And just because you don't like something doesn't mean you can't sit back and be respectful of that person explaining that to you. And that's what democracy is all about. Now we've got a situation where the leaders out there in this country are setting us up so that they can shut us down by saying, oh, that offends somebody, you're now, you know, a misogynist, or you're now a bigot, or whatever, and they use that to control people. And I think that's the real reason why our current president won as president, because the majority of Americans are tired of that, and both parties are guilty of it to some extent, and allowing it to happen or causing it to happen. And that's why, you know, the media goes off on these crazy tweets that our president has, but I think he's out there telling America that he thinks the crazy stuff just like everybody else, and he's not afraid to say it. And I think that's why he has a really good chance of winning again in his reelection, because people are not into that whole political correctness anymore.
You know, I want to put a little plug in here for our weekend special. Jim McKinney is going to be on the show. Jim is very, very active politically. Jim is very conservative. A lot of our listeners don't care for Jim. I happen to consider Jim and his wife to be some of our, Kathy's my best friends. Jim brought up some very, very interesting points at our book club yesterday about the situation with Donald Trump. He is firmly convinced that in spite of what social media is saying right now, that Trump is almost a shoo-in, because the average American, that doesn't necessarily include the Budweiser t-shirt crowd, of which I'm probably one of them, but the average American really appreciates the honesty. Eddie, Irish Tony, I want to know what you think about what Dr. John Huber has to say. And I'm going to hold you to it, especially you, Sir Irish. I value all of your opinions. CFS, out of the box, everybody. See you next week.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.